Okay. In the first of the kinnis that we recited this morning, one of the phrases mentioned there is Nuptu Chasideo, Memei Pros Nuptu Chasideo. The righteous Jews who were driven out of Eretz Yisrael at the time of the destruction of the first Beis Hamikdash, and many of them perished by the waters of the Mei Pros, Pros Nahar Pros, as I mentioned yesterday's leaning, Nahar Pros, is the Euphrates River, and that's the main river in Bavel. And the Torah indicates, the Kinnah indicates that many Jews died because of the waters of the Euphrates River. What is it talking about? So the Medrash tells us that when Jews traveled from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel, so they drank the water from the Euphrates, and they were not used to that water, and that water caused them to get sick and to die. We've heard stories about people going to Mexico. When we went to Eretz Yisrael, you used to have to boil the water. Anybody remember that? You know, there are different types of water in different areas, and people aren't used to it. And so many Jews perished because when they came to Babel, they came to Babylonia after being exiled by the first Beis Hamikdash, they died because of the food and water. They're a different type. And that hammers home the point that one of the results of Churban was Golos, exile. Now that's obvious. But it's not something we tend to focus all that much on, I think. We speak about the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash. We speak about the personal suffering endured by many people during the destruction, both the first or the second Beis HaMikdash. But we sometimes lose sight of the fact that so many people were uprooted from their homes. And just to take a moment to imagine what that was. Okay, we're not talking about the people who died, but the people who suddenly had to pick up and leave where they were from and move and travel somewhere else and start a new life someplace else. That's a tremendously daunting and frightening experience for anybody. And from time to time today, we hear in the news about some refugees from one country or another being driven out because of wars and so on and so forth. And of course, if we reflect back to the Holocaust and the Jews who were driven out of their homes in Europe, we don't have to think that hard to imagine what that was like. And there are people we know, and perhaps even people here, or people whose parents here were themselves lived through that, and deserve unbelievable credit for rebuilding their lives. So the concept of refugees, people being driven out of their country, is an old concept, not something from the 20th century. And it's actually, there is a day, and it's actually June 20th, where the world marks what's called World Refugee Day, commemorating the strength, courage, and perseverance of refugees. But who is included among those refugees that are honored on World Refugee Day? I'm not sure. I do know that in 1945, with the end of World War II, there were some 10 million refugees. I'm not talking about Jews now, including Jews, but 10 million refugees. In 1947, when Great Britain lost control of Southeast Asia, India and Pakistan gained independence, and in effect, 7 million Muslim refugees exchanged places with 7 million Hindu refugees. I mean, more comfortable in the other country. Today, not one of the above is identified as a refugee. Why not? Because they integrated into their host countries, they rebuilt their lives, and they didn't dwell on the fact that they had been driven out of where they came from, and they simply assimilated into the society where they were, and they built their lives. The only exception to that rule are the Arab refugees of 1948, later identified as Palestinians. And about 5 or 6 million, at that time there was 500,000 to 600,000. Now there are about 5 million who identify as refugees from the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948. Jews who were driven out of Arab lands in the aftermath of 1948, and really number, there are different numbers, not clear all the numbers, but somewhere between 600,000 and 900,000, a tremendous number. And one could say, simply put, well, okay, most of these Jews from Arab lands landed up in Israel, and most of these Arabs who had been in Israel landed, you know, we could look at it like the switch of the Pakistani people with the Indian people, but we don't. Instead, the Arabs continued to call themselves refugees because no Arab state ever absorbed them. And the Jews were absorbed in Eretz Yisrael and some not in Eretz Yisrael as well. The fact is, and I dare say that with due respect, most people in this room, most people in general, are not aware of the fact that during the 20th century, close to 1 million Jews were expelled from Arab countries. It's a forgotten fact of history. I want to read you an article which was just printed. One of my daughters referred me to this article, printed June 22nd this year, just a little more than not even a month ago. It was printed by David Harris, who is the CEO of the AJC, the American Jewish Committee. And he writes as follows. My roots are nearly 2,600 years old. My ancestors made landmark contributions from North Africa to the Fertile Crescent, but I barely exist today. You see, I am a Jew from the Arab world. No, that's not entirely accurate. I fall into a semantic trap. I predated the Arab conquest in just about every country in which I lived. When Arab invaders conquered North Africa, for example, I had already been present there for more than six centuries. We know one of the great halachists of all time, the Rif. You've heard of the Rif? The Rif stands for Rabbi Yitzchak of Fez, let's say in North Africa. Okay, he lived around the year 1000 of the Common Era. Okay, just to give you an idea. Okay, but in any event, and many great Jews lived in these places. Going back to Mr. Harris's presentation. Today, you cannot find a trace of me in most of this vast region. Try seeking me out in Iraq. Remember the Babylonian exile from ancient Judea following the destruction of the first temple in 586 BCE? Remember the vibrant Jewish community that emerged there and produced the Babylonian Talmud? Do you know that in the 9th century, under Muslim rule, we Jews in Iraq were forced to wear a distinctive yellow patch on our clothing? The Nazis didn't make that up. A precursor of the infamous Nazi yellow badge, and faced other discriminatory measures? Or that in the 11th and 14th century we faced onerous taxes, the destruction of several synagogues, and severe repression? And I wonder if you have ever heard of the Farhud, the breakdown of law and order in Baghdad in June 1941. As an American Jewish committee specialist, Dr. George Gruen reported, quote, in a spasm of uncontrolled violence, between 170 and 180 Jews were killed, more than 900 were wounded, and 14,500 Jews sustained material losses through the looting or destruction of their stores and homes. Although the government eventually restored order, Jews were squeezed out of government employment, limited in schools, and subjected to imprisonment, heavy fines, or sequestration of their property on the flimsiest of charges of being connected to either or both of the two banned movements. Indeed, communism and Zionism were frequently equated in the statutes. In Iraq, the mere receipt of a letter from a Jew in Palestine before 1948 was sufficient to bring about arrest and loss of property. At our peak, we were 135,000 Jews in Iraq now. We were 135,000 Jews in 1948, and we were a vitally important factor in virtually every aspect of Iraqi society. To illustrate our role, here's what the Encyclopedia Judaica wrote about Iraqi Jewry, quote, during the 20th century, Jewish intellectuals, authors, and poets made an important contribution to the Arabic language and literature by writing books and numerous essays. By 1950, other Iraqi Jews and I were faced with revocation of citizenship, seizure of assets, and most ominously, public hangings. A year earlier, Iraqi Prime Minister Nuri Said had told the British ambassador in Amman of a plan to expel the entire Jewish community and place us at Jordan's doorstep. The ambassador later recounted the episode in a memoir entitled From the Wings, Amman Memoirs, 1947 to 1951. Miraculously, in 1951, about 100,000 of us got out, thanks to the extraordinary help of Israel, but with little more than the clothes on our back. The Israelis, some of you may have heard this, dubbed the rescue operation Operation Ezra Nehemiah. Those of us who stayed lived in perpetual fear of violence and more public hangings, as occurred on January 27, 1969, when 9 Jews were hanged in the center of Baghdad on trumped-up charges, while hundreds of thousands of Iraqis wildly cheered the execution. 1969, we're not talking about 500 years ago. The rest of us got out one way or another, including friends of mine who found safety in Iran when it was still ruled by the Shah. Now there are no Jews left to speak of, nor are there even any monuments, museums, or other visible reminders of our presence on Iraqi soil for 26 centuries. 2,600 years are erased, wiped out, as if they never happened. Can you put yourself in my shoes and feel the excruciating pain of loss and invisibility? I'm a forgotten Jew. I was first settled in what is present-day Libya by the Egyptian ruler Ptolemy Lagos in 323 BCE, according to the first-century Jewish historian Josephus. My forefathers and foremothers lived continuously on this soil for more than 2 millennia. Our numbers bolstered by Berbers who converted to Judaism, Spanish and Portuguese Jews fleeing the Inquisition, and Italian Jews crossing the Mediterranean. I was confronted with the anti-Jewish legislation of the occupying Italian fascists. I endured the incarceration of 2,600 fellow Jews in an Axis-run camp in 1942, obviously during World War II. I survived the deportation of 200 fellow Jews to Italy the same year. I coped with forced labor in Libya during the war. I witnessed local rioting in 1945 and 1948 that left nearly 150 Libyan Jews dead, hundreds injured, and thousands homeless. I watched with uncertainty as Libya became an independent country in 1951. I wonder what would happen to the 6,000 of us still living here, the remnant of the 39,000 Jews who had formed this once proud community. That is, until the rioting sent people packing, many headed for the newly established state of Israel. The good news was that there were constitutional protections for minority groups in the new Libyan nation. The bad news was that they were completely ignored. Within 10 years of my native country's independence, I could not vote, hold public office, serve in the army, obtain a passport, purchase new property, acquire majority ownership in any new business, or even participate in the supervision of our community's affairs, our own community's affairs. By June 1967, the die was cast. Those of us who had remained, hoping against hope that things would improve in a land to which we were deeply attached and which at times had been good to us, had no choice but to flee. The Six-Day War created an explosive atmosphere in the streets. 18 Jews were killed. Jewish-owned homes and shops were burned to the ground. You know, I mean, we had here in the United States that during the recent flare-up in Gaza, Jewish people attacked in the streets. I and 4,000 other Jews left however we could. Most of us were no more than a suitcase and the equivalent of a few dollars. I was never allowed to return. I never recovered the assets that I had left behind in Libya, despite promises by the government. In effect, everything was stolen. The homes, furniture, shops, communal institutions, you name it. Still worse, I was never able to visit the grave sites of my relatives. That hurt especially deeply. In fact, I was told that under Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, many of us remember him, who seized power in 1969, the Jewish cemeteries were bulldozed and the headstones used for building roads. I'm a forgotten Jew. My experience, the good and bad, lives on in my memory, and I'll do my best to transmit it to my children and grandchildren. How can they absorb? How much can they identify with a culture that seems like a relic of a past that appears increasingly remote and intangible? True, a few books and articles on my history have been written, but, and here I'm being generous, they are far from bestsellers. In any case, can these books compete with the systematic attempt by Libyan leaders to expunge any trace of my presence over two millennia? I repeat, can they vie with a world that paid virtually no attention to the end of my existence? Take a look at the New York Times Index for 1967, and you'll see for yourself how the quote-unquote newspaper of record covered the tragic demise of an ancient community. I can save you the trouble of looking. Just a few paltry lines were all the story they got. I'm a forgotten Jew. I am one of hundreds of thousands of Jews who once lived in countries like Iraq and Libya. All told, we numbered close to 900,000 in 1948. Today, there are fewer than 4,000, mostly concentrated in two countries, Morocco and Tunisia. We were once vibrant communities in Aden, that's by Yemen, Algeria, Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and other nations with roots dating back literally 2,000 years and more. Now we are next to none. Why does no one speak of us and our story? Why does the world relentlessly and obsessively speak of the Palestinian refugees from the 1948 and 1967 wars in the Middle East, who not unimportantly were displaced by wars launched by their own Arab brethren, but totally ignore the Jewish refugees from 1948 and 1967 wars? Why is the world left with the impression that there's only one refugee population from the Arab-Israeli conflict, when in fact there are two refugee populations, and our numbers were quite a bit larger than that of the Palestinians? I've spent many sleepless nights trying to understand this injustice. Should I blame myself? Perhaps we Jews from Arab countries accepted our fate too passively. Maybe we failed to seize the opportunity to tell our story. Look at the Jews of Europe. They turned to articles, books, poems, plays, paintings, and films to recount their stories. They depicted the period of joy and the period of tragedy, and they did it in a way that also captured the imagination of many non-Jews. Perhaps I was too fatalistic, too shell-shocked, or just too uncertain of my artistic or literary talents. But that can't be the only reason for my unsought status as a forgotten Jew. It's not that I haven't tried to make at least some noise. I have. I've organized gatherings and petitions, arranged exhibitions, appealed to the United Nations, and met with officials from just about every Western government. But somehow it all seems to add up to less than the sum of its parts. No, that's still being too kind. The truth is, it has pretty much fallen on deaf ears. You know the acronym MEGO, MEGO. It means my eyes glazed over. That's the impression I often have when I've tried raising the subject of the Jews from Arab lands with diplomats, elected officials, and journalists. Their eyes glaze over. TEGO, TEGO. No, I shouldn't be blaming myself, though I could be always doing more for the sake of history and justice. There's actually a far more important explanatory factor, I believe. We Jews in the Arab world picked up the pieces of our shattered lives after our hurried departures in the wake of intimidation, violence, and discrimination, and we moved on. We didn't stand still, wallow in self-pity, or pass on our victim status to our children and our children's children. Most of us went to Israel, where we were given a new start. The years following our arrival weren't always easy. We began at the bottom, and we had to work our way up. We came with varying levels of education and little in the way of tangible assets. We had something more to sustain us through the difficult process of adjustment and acculturation: our immeasurable pride as Jews, our deeply rooted faith, our cherished rabbis and customs, and our commitment to Israel's survival and well-being. Some of us, somewhere between one-fourth and one-third of the total, chose to go elsewhere. Jews from French-speaking Arab countries gravitated toward France and towards Quebec in Canada. Jews from Libya created communities in Rome and Milan. Egyptian and Lebanese Jews were sprinkled throughout Europe and North America, and some resettled in Brazil. Syrian Jews immigrated to the United States, especially New York, as well as to Mexico City and Panama City, and on and on. Wherever we settled, we put our shoulder to the wheel and we created new lives. We learned the local language in case we didn't already know it, found jobs, sent our children to schools, and as soon as we could, built our own congregations to preserve the customs, rites, and rituals that were distinctive to our tradition. I would never underestimate the difficulties or overlook those who, for reasons of age or ill health or poverty, couldn't make it. But by and large, in a short time, we took giant steps, whether in Israel or elsewhere. I may be a forgotten Jew, but my voice will not remain silent. It cannot, for if it does, it becomes an accomplice to historical denial and revisionism. I will speak out because I will not allow the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to be defined unfairly through the prism of one refugee population only, the Palestinians. I will speak out because what happened to me is now being done with eerie familiarity to other minority groups in that region, including Christians and Yazidis, and once again, I see the world averting its eyes as if denial ever solved anything. I will speak out because I refuse to be a forgotten Jew. So here is, a beautiful presentation. And what I'd like to do in the little time that we have is kind of go through just some of the numbers and some of the events that took place in the various countries. So we become educated Jews here living in the United States, living in the present, and are aware of what happened because I think, as I said at the outset, most of us have never thought too much about this and not really aware of it. Again, much is heard about Palestinian refugees after 1948 and 1967, but again, little about the hundreds of thousands of Jews who had to flee from Arab states, okay? And again, mostly because they were assimilated into their home. Actually, the Knesset in 2015 established November 30th as a day of recognition for Jewish refugees from Arab countries. That's in 2015. That's quite a long time afterwards, okay? That's even among Jews, even in Israel, okay? But 2015. To look at some statistics and some numbers, and we'll look at specific countries as well a little bit. In 1945, roughly a million, 1945, again, we're not talking about hundreds of years ago. In 1945, roughly 1 million Jews lived peacefully in the Arab states of the Middle East, many of them, as we just saw, in communities that had existed for hundreds, if not even thousands of years. Okay, actually, after the Arabs rejected the United Nations decision known as the Partition Plan to partition Palestine and create a Jewish state, we know the Arabs rejected that plan. The Jews in Arab lands became targets of their own government's anti-Zionist fervor. Egypt's delegate to the United Nations in 1947 told the General Assembly, quote, "The lives of 1 million Jews in Muslim countries will be jeopardized by partition." In other words, if we go ahead and vote in favor of this plan, it's putting the Jews in our countries in danger. That dire warning quickly became the reality. Okay. Throughout 1947 and 1948, Jews in all these countries, Algeria, Egypt, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Yemen, were persecuted, their property and their belongings were confiscated, and they were subjected to riots and so on. In Iraq, Zionism became a capital offense. Okay, in Syria, there were pogroms in Aleppo, Jewish bank accounts were frozen, bombs were detonated in the Jewish quarter in Egypt, killing dozens, anti-Jewish decrees were passed in Algeria, and so on. In January of 1948, the World Jewish Congress here in the United States, where the president was Dr. Stephen Wise appealed to the United States Secretary of State, then George Marshall, okay, quote, "Between 800,000 and a million Jews in the Middle East and North Africa, exclusive of Palestine, are in the greatest danger of destruction at the hand of Muslims being incited to holy war over the partition of Palestine. Acts of violence already perpetrated, together with those contemplated, being clearly aimed at the total destruction of the Jews, constitute genocide. which under the general of the resolutions of the General Assembly is a crime against humanity. In May 1948, the New York Times had a headline, quote, Jews in grave danger in all Muslim lands, 900,000 in Africa and Asia face the wrath of their foes. So this was a very, very real event. This was a very real concern. This again, 1947, 1948, okay. Many Jews understandably fled of the 800, of what, again, there are different articles, and I, you know, took notes and put together material from different articles. So the numbers are not clear, especially in that part of the world. They didn't have exact census numbers and so on. Not that everything here is so exact either, but the discrepancy in terms of numbers. We're talking about between 700,000 and 900,000, okay? Some close to 600,000 actually resettled in Israel, at great expense, by the way, to the Israeli government, without any compensation from the Arab governments who confiscated their possessions. Okay, and that's Eretz Yisrael, and they took them in. Okay, and we've heard of Operation Flying Carpet, all these different things, Yemen, different things. They, the Jewish absorbed. There were issues with the absorption too, which is not for today's discussion. Okay, but again, little is heard about them because they simply did not remain refugees for long. They absorbed themselves into the society. Okay, obviously, in Israel, you know, a huge influx of immigrants, which nearly at that time in the late 1940s, in effect, doubled the population. Obviously put a great strain on an economy already struggling just to get started, right? I mean, you know, it was a new country surrounded by enemies and so on. But the Jewish state never considered turning away these people and over the years absorbed into society. Just to understand, overall, the number of Jews fleeing Arab countries for Israel in the years following the State of Israel's independence nearly double the number of Arabs leaving Palestine, okay? And the contrast between the Jewish refugees and the Palestinian refugees grows even starker considering the difference in cultural and geographic dislocation. Most of the Jewish refugees traveled hundreds or even thousands of miles to get to a tiny country which was just getting underway, which spoke a different language and was headed by people with different traditions. I mean, the Ashkenazic Jews that, you know, founded the state and so on and so forth. I'm not talking about it on a religious level. That's a whole different discussion, okay? Because many of the original leaders of Eretz Yisrael were not religious, and many of the Jews coming from these other lands were religious, but they had different customs and different Nusach HaTfilah and all kinds of differences, and a different culture, really, a different culture. I mean, some of you may remember, maybe I'm dating myself a little bit, but some of you may remember a humorous film, Salat Shabbati. Remember the Salat Shabbati? You know, with Kishon's work, and it was starring, what's his name? Was it Topol? I forgot who. Anyway, but, oh no, I don't know where it was. But, you know, and it's a focus on the cultural differences. But that's the way it was. It was realistic. Moreover, the value of Jewish property that was left behind by the Jews who fled Arab countries is currently estimated to be at least 50% higher than the total value of assets of Palestinian refugees. So we're talking about people abandoning homes, property, wealth, and so on and so forth. Okay, in 1950, John Meacham Berncastle, under the aegis of the United Nations Conciliation Commission for Palestine, estimated that the total assets lost by Palestinian refugees from 1948, including land, buildings, movable property, and frozen bank accounts, amounted to roughly $350 million. Okay, adding in an additional $100 million for assets lost by Palestinian refugees as a result of the Six-Day War, so you can come with an approximate total of $450 million. Okay? By contrast, the value of Jewish assets lost by the Jewish refugees, compiled by similar methodology, comes to $700 million. So it's close to double. Close to double. To date, more than 100 UN resolutions have been passed referring explicitly to the fate of Palestinian refugees. Not one U.S. resolution has been passed regarding Jewish refugees from Arab lands. Okay, the United Nations created an organization, which we hear of all the time today, UNRWA, right? United Nations Relief Work Agency for Palestinians, solely to handle Palestinian refugees, while all other refugees in the world are handled collectively by one organization within the UN, the United Nations Human Rights Commission. The UN defines Palestinian refugees differently, okay, allowing distinction that, you know, allow the numbers to grow all the time. So now you have 5 million who are considered refugees when maybe there was 400,000, 500,000 who were displaced at the time. Okay, today, nearly half of Israel's population, native population, the Jewish population of Israel, nearly half descends from the Jewish refugees of the Arab world from those years. Okay, and These issues, some of these issues come up in the Oslo Accords and Camp David summits and so on and so forth. Okay, and recently not in service anymore in that role, but the Deputy Foreign Minister Dani Ayalon, Israeli Dani Ayalon, has called on the United Nations Secretary General to hold a summit specifically regarding the issue of Jewish refugees from Arab lands. Like I mentioned, the Knesset finally established a day to commemorate. On November 30th, to commemorate and honor the Jewish refugees and so on. The goal of that legislation is to make sure the younger generation is informed about this critical period of Israeli history. And I would say not only the younger generation, but not all of us here are from the younger generation, some of us are. But I won't date anybody, absolutely not. But the claim is that most young Israelis and even old Israelis are entirely ignorant of this aspect of Jewish history. And I hope that this national recognition will spark some kind of international recognition. An article was written by Professor Shmuel Trigano, a professor of sociology at the University of Paris. He's the director of the College of Jewish Studies at the Alliance Israelite Universelle, right? An editor of a journal there, a Journal of Jewish Studies. And he wrote the following regarding this event. He suggested, and again, his number is 900,000 Jews between 1920 and 1970 were expelled from Arab lands, especially again once the State of Israel was established. And he posits that in effect there were six different aspects, or six different measures that contributed to this. That's what he presents, and I'm going to use his presentation. Denationalization. One, legal discrimination. Two, isolation. Three, economic despoilment. Four, socioeconomic discrimination. Five, and the old mainstay, pogroms, okay, or similar acts. Now, he writes that it's the custom to say that Zionism is responsible for this development. He rejects that. He says that even without the rise of the State of Israel, there was a rise in Arab Islamic nationalism, and that contributed to it. And there's what to say for that. It's not really what I want to go through today, but that's his... Well, wait, we'll see. Yeah, so some were, and the point was just raised, many of these people actually fled. But the truth of the matter is, and the Arab refugees in the state were also not expelled for the most part. They were told to leave by the Arab leaders, leave for a few weeks, a few months. Once we push the Jews into the sea, you can come back. So expelled is a hard, you know, it's a good point, but it's not, in other words, many of the Arabs, quote-unquote Arab refugees, also were not expelled, they weren't thrown out. So people were thrown out. Okay, but many Arabs are saying Haifa and other places, they were told by their leaders, and this is documented, you know, you'll stay out, you're safe, and you'll come back. You know, we're going to push the Jews into the sea, and you'll get even more when you come back. And then suddenly they lost, didn't turn out that way. We'll get to it, though, a little bit. Okay? And the next question is, what do you mean, since you brought it up, and I'll say it now, so what do you mean by expel? And if you take away a person's rights to having a business, you know, you weren't actually told you have to leave the country, but circumstances are such. So, you know, expelled is I mean, it's a very important point. Okay, I'm using expelled in the larger, meaning. But as we'll see, when Jews didn't have rights to have business or to own, to have a bank account and so on and so forth, and they were constantly in the fear of their attack or of the shuls being burnt down and so on, so you can say they weren't technically told you have to leave, but, you know, what kind of life is that? So, you know, that's important. And that's, I think, he's going at. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, as I said, we'll see. I'm not going to cover everything, but yes, in some kind, they actually were told they have to leave, absolutely. But I'm including in these numbers, in these articles, including the numbers, even those who weren't technically told, as they absolutely were, in Yemen also, in other places they were told they had to leave, no question. Okay, but no doubt about it. But there's some places they weren't told they had to leave, but the circumstances were such, you can't go on. I mean, you know, so... But that again, those are the things that he's saying. You know, you had pogroms and you had socioeconomic discrimination and so on. So again, most of these events have been obscured, but that's the way it is. Okay, in fact, the truth of the matter is, some people refer to this. This professor writes this as the forgotten exodus, and he doesn't like that term because exodus implies you went out kind of willingly. Right? They left. It was a mass exodus. You know, and he felt, you know, what do you mean exodus? You know, exodus. It implies that, you know, that they did this completely willingly, and it's simply not the case. Okay, so those are his six, and I'm trying to look at a little bit about in some of the concepts, each of these six things that this professor Sugano presents. The denationalization of Jews. So Jews were isolated by in society by legal process and laws passed in many lands. Okay, this was usually the first stage. Okay, I mean, look, we know history, going back to the Holocaust, which at least we American Jews, European origin Jews, know better. Okay, that also happened. I mean, the Nuremberg Laws and so on and so forth were originally, you know, the Jews didn't have to leave, but, you know, they were excluded from different parts of society. They weren't allowed to sit over here, or the kids couldn't go to school, whatever else. So that's always the beginning, okay? In Egypt, okay, in 1920, there was something called the Treaty of Sevres, which was a peace treaty between the Allies after World War I and the Ottomans, that the basically one of the results of the world of World War I. We need to understand this just very quickly. Well, all the countries in the Middle East, including what we call it Israel, call it Palestine, whatever you want, Jordan, there was no Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, Syria, Iran. There was a big blob, okay, basically, one big mass, landmass, which was under the control of the Turkish so-called Ottoman Empire. And this was just, it was under them. And there were local areas were ruled by local sheikhs and so on and so forth. There was no boundaries like we have today with Iraq and Jordan and Saudi Arabia and Yemen. They didn't exist. Okay, this was that happened as a result of World War I when the Ottoman Empire, which had been in power for several hundred years, but by the time of World War I was basically declining significantly, they were on the, you know, the Germans, they were on the losing side in World War I. So when you're losing side, you know, you lose the land. So that's how England, which is on the winning side, and France, on the winning side, got control of some of those countries, which are what we call today, you know, in the Middle East. Okay, in any event, in Egypt, there was a treaty between the Allies and the Ottomans, okay, which addressed the issue of nationality in Egypt, okay, and one of the articles in this treaty was that there is such a thing as belonging to a race is what you need to be considered an Egyptian, okay? And so the Jews were now suddenly, because they did not belong to the Muslim population, they were now dissociated from the majority of the country, okay? There were other nationalizing laws in 1927 and 1929. An Egyptian was defined of somebody. An Egyptian was defined as somebody who had Arab-Muslim affiliation. So therefore, Jews, despite many of them living in Egypt for centuries, okay, again, you know, we're all of us sitting here, living here, we're Americans, we're Jewish American. We're an American the same way, Christian, Donald Buck is an American, or whatever, right? Jews used to be considered to be Egyptian, but after these laws were passed, Jews were no longer considered Egyptians. And there was a lot of nationalism and that national laws that passed to support and to build up, you know, pride in being an Egyptian, and Jews, of course, were excluded for that. And many, many Jews became, in effect, stateless, okay? And Jews were immediately, as soon as Israel became on the scene, Jews were immediately suspected of, quote-unquote, dual loyalty, and we've heard that before, and the accusation that all Jews are Zionist. Okay, now, the Egyptian community, in effect, the truth of the matter is most of the Jews living in Egypt in the early 20th century were not part of the Arab culture and not only even spoke Arabs, they were members of other diverse groups in Egypt. Greeks, Armenians, Syrian Christians, and Italians. A lot of them lived in Egypt. Okay. Now, the Egyptian government, as you just said, eventually made it very difficult for non-Muslims, foreigners to become naturalized. Okay. And the drive to the goal of Egyptianizing public life and so on, and the economy, harmed these minorities. And although technically speaking, Jews could apply for such a membership or such citizenship, it was really, in effect, the Jews were seen as an enemy. They were attacked because of any link to Zionism, whether real or imagined, okay? And the persecution here, quote-unquote, really was more not so much religion, but for political reasons. Indeed, the Egyptian Prime Minister Mahmoud Pasha told the British ambassador, quote, all Jews are potential Zionists and all Zionists are communists. Okay, that was the understanding, and therefore that made all Jews basically an enemy. Okay, and as I mentioned before, in 1947, the Egyptian representative of the United Nations said that the lives of all the Jews, million Jews in Muslim countries, would be jeopardized by the establishment of a Jewish state. On 24th of November 1947, Dr. Haykal Pasha, an Egyptian official, said, quote, if the UN decides to amputate a part of Palestine in order to establish a Jewish state, Jewish blood will necessarily be shed elsewhere in the Arab world to place in certain and serious danger a million Jews. Okay, another leader said, imposed partition will result in bloodshed both in Palestine and in the rest of the Arab world. All right. In 1948, approximately 75,000 Jews lived in Egypt. Okay. Subsequent, around the establishment of the state, about 20,000 left. And there were a couple of major events that made them leave. Number one, we'll speak in a moment, the 1948 Cairo bombings. Again, Jewish community. And some left after the Egyptian Revolution, 1952, and what's called the Lavon Affair, an ill-fated Israeli operation. The details are somewhat sketchy. Something was called Operation Susanna, where they tried to get a group of Egyptian Jews recruited by the Israeli military intelligence to plant bombs inside Egyptian and American and British-owned civilian targets after hours, and nobody after closing time, so nobody's going to get hurt. But the idea was that it would be blamed on the Muslim Brotherhood, and we hear about to this day. And it didn't work. Okay, and after that, it was called the Lavon Affair because the Israeli defense minister at the time was Pinchas Lavon, who had to resign because of his failure. He claimed he knew nothing about it. Later on, it became clear that they did. It was simply a failed operation. But in any event, many Jews had to leave after. Many Jews, thousands of Jews left after that. But I'll speak for a moment about, and also in the aftermath of that, in the aftermath of the 1956, the so-called Sinai campaign, quote, 1,000 Jews were arrested and 500 Jewish businesses were seized by the government. A statement branded the Jews as Zionists and enemies of the state that was read in mosques in Cairo and Alexandria. Jewish bank accounts were confiscated. Many Jews lost their jobs. Lawyers, engineers, doctors, and teachers were not allowed to work in their respective professions. And therefore, and at that time, as you mentioned, thousands of Jews indeed were ordered to leave the country. Okay, they were ordered to leave the country. And they were allowed to take with them one suitcase. This is like today, flying today, right? They're allowed to take one suitcase and a small, today you have to pay for it. Right, and a small sum of cash, right? Small sum of money. That's all they could take with them, okay? And what about all their property? They were forced to sign something, quote unquote, donating their property to the Egyptian government. Their property was seized by the Egyptian government. Foreign observers reported that members of Jewish families were taken hostage to make sure that no one would speak against the Jewish government. So again, Jews were expelled or left, forced out by these feelings. Some 25,000, almost half of the Jewish community left, mainly for Europe and the United States and for South America and for Israel. So that's the situation in Egypt. Three countries where Jews, Arab countries, Jews fared better were Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia. Fared comparatively better, okay? Although not Libya, which is right there. In Tunisia, Morocco, and Algeria, Jews did not face large-scale expulsion or outright asset confiscations. Not to say there were no problems, but generally speaking, they were they had it better in those places. Today, despite the dwindling numbers, Jews do play a role in Morocco today, and Jews can visit Morocco today. The King of Morocco has a Jewish advisor, okay, and Jewish schools and synagogues receive government subsidies. All right, now that's not to say that there aren't attacks. There have been attacks in 2003. Some people may remember this: the bombing the Jewish community center in Casablanca. Okay, so there have been sporadic things. But many Israeli Jews go visit Morocco, especially if they come from Morocco, especially around the time of Rosh Hashanah or Pesach. They go there, and the king has offered to Jews to come back. I don't think too many have taken them up, but they've taken it back. Algeria as well. Okay, most Jews left Algeria in 1962 after the country became independent, and many of them were originally French citizens. And the last Algeria synagogue was abandoned after 1994. In 1948, approximately 105,000 Jews lived in Tunisia. Today, there's about 1,000 Jews, 1% left. Okay, there today. Those countries had it better. A country like Libya, for example, get back to Libya also. In June of 1951, it was decreed that the personal status of non-Muslims, including Jews, would be governed by their religious courts in a manner of what they called dhimmi. In Arab lands, in Muslim lands, there's a status called dhimmi, D-H-I-M-M-I, is how we spell it in English. It means that these people are second-class citizens, but they do have protection. They do have certain rights. Okay, a Muslim will never be punished for attacking or killing a Jew, but they did have certain rights, and that's what they stayed in Libya, at least for a while. But anyway, that's in terms of in terms of nationalistic issues. Legal discrimination was number two on this professor's list. Legal discrimination. In Libya in 1953, Jews were victims of economic boycotts. Jews had what they called the Maccabi Sports Club in Libya. The Maccabi Sports Club in 1954 was forcibly required to admit Arab members. In 1957, Libyans with relatives in Israel had to register at the Libyan office, okay, to know that they had relatives in Israel, which was not a good thing for them. And on December 3rd, 1958, in Tripoli, the big city, Jewish community ceased to be an independent entity. It was overseen by a state-appointed commissioner. By 1960, in Libya, so this is what's happened, they're not expelled, Jews were no longer allowed to vote, to hold public office, or to serve in the army, or to serve in the police. Okay, again, the Jewish Community Council was dissolved. In April of 1960, all schools under the Alliance Israélite Universelle from France were ordered closed. Jewish schools had to close. In 1961, law was issued requiring Libyan citizenship in order to transfer and possess property, and Jews who applied for citizenship were basically all rejected. Jews, they said, couldn't vote, they couldn't serve in the army, they couldn't afford to serve in the police. In 1970, the Libyan government issued new laws that confiscated all assets of Libya's Jews, including certain bonds that they had and so on. The bonds matured, no compensation was paid, and Gaddafi was at that time already the head of Libya, and he said the alignment of Jews with Israel as the Arab nation's enemy has forfeited their right to any compensation. So that's in Libya. Expelled? No, but obviously their lives were not really livable for the long term. Similarly, in Lebanon and other places, Jewish organizations, Zionist organizations, sports clubs were forbidden. It's interesting, in Iraq, okay, the British mandate over Iraq, there was a British mandate of Iraq like there was over Palestine. The British mandate in Iraq ended in June 1930, became independent in 1932. And Iraq at that time also had a large population of people from other backgrounds. So there was an Assyrian community, okay? There was an Assyrian church, an Eastern church, a Chaldean Catholic church, a Syriac Orthodox church, okay? And many of these people were massacred, and there was a sign to the Jewish community that minority rights were meaningless at this point. With the 1936 to 1939 Arab revolts in Israel, in Palestine, many people, including the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, was a great enemy of the Jews, preached pan-Arab theology. All the Arabs have to unite. And again, much anti-Zionist propaganda. It's interesting that in World War II, or leading up to World War II, Nazi propaganda made its way into Iraq. Dr. Fritz Grobe, who resided in Iraq since 1932, disseminated hateful propaganda against Jews and, believe it or not, an Arabic translation of Hitler's Mein Kampf. An Arabic translation and appeared in the 1930s in Iraq, and Radio Berlin broadcast in Arabic in Iraq. Obviously, this was not something that boded well for the Jews. In Yemen, Sharia law Muslim law was instituted in 1913, which again weakened the condition of the Jews. Decrees specifying forced conversion of orphans were issued in the 1920s, and Jews again were excluded from public service, from the army. Same thing happened in Syria, and we mentioned before in Egypt. In Tunisia, a law concerning Judaism put an end to a Jewish community for a time. In Turkey, there were all these countries. Again, this is all under what this professor refers to as the second of these six issues: legal discrimination. Again, it was legal. Countries can pass whatever laws they want. And if you don't like it, you can leave, which many Jews did, but we can obviously understand that that's also under expulsion, indirectly. Three is isolation. Isolation. Interestingly enough, the Jews were persecuted, but very often couldn't leave because they couldn't get passports, okay? Mail wasn't delivered from Israel and so on, and Jews, in effect, became prisoners. They had to stay there. Some of us will recall the Soviet Jewry situation before the fall of communism and so on, when they didn't want to stay, but they couldn't leave. They didn't let they don't want them, but they don't want to let them go. It's exactly a similar kind of situation. So de facto, you're a prisoner. Okay. In 1948, Iraq prohibited Jews from leaving the country. Okay, in 1951, Libyan Jews were not allowed to have a passport or any other nationality certificate. Okay, only traveling documents for business reasons, and it was not automatic that it would be renewed. In Yemen, Jews were not allowed to leave in 1949. Tunisia stopped postal relations with Israel in 1956. In 1973, Syria prohibited Jews from communicating with anybody abroad. So that's what I say in terms of isolation. Jews were isolated. Point number four, economic despoilment. Jewish economic assets were always targeted. Their liquid assets, bank accounts, property, were always subject to nationalization. Stolen when they left, no compensation. Okay, in Turkey, in 1942, a tax was imposed only on Jews. It's a tax, just Jews. Okay, Morocco held Jews anxious to emigrate to Israel for ransom in 1961. The World Jewish Congress paid $250 to the government for each Jew who was permitted to leave the country. It was a money-making operation. Okay. Okay. Just to look a little bit at, I'm going to have a lot of information about different countries, but I want to focus more on I have a lot of interesting things about Iraq and so on, which was always a tough place. Maybe we'll have time to come back to it. The fifth point that I should like to mention. One second. Is socioeconomic discrimination. Okay, all Jewish entrepreneurs lost ownership of businesses. Many Jewish in 1950 in Iraq, the government seized control of the banks, so like the bankruptcy of stockbrokers, many of whom were Jewish. In Syria, Jews were prohibited from working in agriculture in February 1950. In Libya, a ban against employing Jews in petroleum companies. Libya is a big oil-producing company. Jews couldn't work in oil companies. In Egypt, in 1947, a law concerning companies decreed the Egyptianization of public and trade affairs. 75%, they had quotas, 75% of employees had to be, quote-unquote, real Egyptians, meaning Arabs or Muslims, as opposed to Jews. Okay. In 1948... the ruler of Yemen forced Jews to pass on their trade expertise, to train, for nothing, of course, Muslims and Arabs before they got to leave the country. You had to train, the Jews had to train them and then give away their business. But of course, point number six, pogroms and related events. Obviously, this was always a situation, riots, arrests, murders of public figures, destruction of shuls. Okay, this took place, almost regularly. In 1945, in Egypt, anti-British riots and anti-Semitic riots broke out. There were arrests. 1,000 Jews were detained and accused of being Zionist. Okay, the 26th of January 1952 was what they called Black Saturday, riots and acts of violence against Jews. Okay, there was something in 1945 known as the Balfour Day riots. Okay, anti-Jewish demonstrations on the 28th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration Arthur Lord Balfour gave official British support. Okay, following World War I, the establishment of a state in Israel, and it was 1917 before World War I was actually over, and we know about Balfour Declaration, Balfour Day. Okay, rallies were organized by the Muslim Brotherhood. Again, we hear from them today as well. And there were Balfour Day riots. 5 Egyptian Jews were killed, 1 Muslim policeman. Greek schools were also damaged and so on. And while the leaders of the country, the king and so on, denounced the violence, and the king actually met with one of the leading rabbis, nonetheless, at the end, it was that the Jews were accused of having provoked it was really their fault, so nothing we can do about it. In 1948, bombings in Cairo targeted Jewish areas. Okay, between June and September 1948, 70 Jews were killed, nearly 200 wounded. Riots that took many other lives. Okay, the bomb was originally planted in the Karaite quarter of Cairo. These are Jews we don't think about, but the Karaites is a community in Egypt. So they were, a bomb was planted in their quarter. 22 Jews were killed, 41 wounded. Okay, a number of weeks later, there was a demonstration. During the war, the Israeli the war, the Israeli Independence War, so some Israeli Air Force bombed a neighborhood in Cairo. actually during Ramadan, and civilians were killed, the same problem in Gaza, and it was a quote-unquote spontaneous demonstration, march to the Jewish quarter, and there was a word went out there was going to be another big bombing, which was a false alarm, and again there were riots destroying Jewish stores, killing Jewish people, and so on. So these were things that were going on in Egypt in June, July 1934, pogroms in Turkey. In Iraq, in June 1941, was the famous Farhud pogrom. 180 Jews killed, more than 600 injured. A wave of anti-Jewish persecutions, arrests, fines took place. Okay, Shafik Adas, a Jewish millionaire, was accused of selling surplus military stockpiles to Israel. May have been true, but he was executed in September 1948. Anyone who belonged to the Zionist movement was persecuted in 1949. Shuls were attacked, people were killed, many people injured. And again, this Farhud was really the turning point. That's what I've been told, actually, by people from the Jews who came from Iraq. That was the turning point for the Jews in Iraq. Okay, really, there was stuff that came afterwards. It started, you know, again, these things start always innocently enough, but eventually there's an excuse to attack and to kill and so on. Again, I think we've painted a picture that the Jews in these countries were subject to riots and to attacks and to de-legitimization of their business, to seizing of property, to attacks on individuals, years later. Okay, in Libya in 1969, it's not that long ago, an anti-Semitic campaign was instituted against the Jews. Jewish cemeteries, we said before, were destroyed. 64 shuls were destroyed, okay, and changed into mosques, or in Benghazi into Coptic churches. And again, I have personal stories here, but the time doesn't permit. I'll just mention, in Syria and other places, many of these events. There was a woman by the name of Judy Feldkar, whose name should be remembered, Latov. She was successful in smuggling many Jews out of Syria, okay, and brought the plight of the Syrian Jews to the attention of the world, okay, and she should remember it. She was really, it's a fascinating story. Perhaps we'll talk about it at a different time.
Yeah. One of the young men she had brought to Tel Aviv, that married in Brooklyn. She was invited to Marshall Gallery.
Wow, yeah. All right, so she's a heroine of Jews. Again, we don't, I say we, I'm from an Ashkenazi background, American background, I don't know about that. We should be aware of this, but this is part of our history. And again, on and on, Jewish areas plundered, Jewish stuff seized. I have many, many more statistics here, and the time doesn't permit. But bottom line, all of these events together created a system of systematic, often gradual, but systematic discrimination. And there were abuses and violence and so on. And eventually, again, Jews left. You can define the word expelled as you wish. As I said before, Zionism is blamed for it, and it may have accelerated it, but it appears that this was something which really predated Zionism, and the treatment of Jews in other lands is always something which you can blame it on. The Germans had things to blame it on also. But just to look at some numbers, I have just some numbers, so you get the picture of what happened in these places. Okay, I'll take a look at Algeria. I will look at quickly at the years 1948 to 2018. Okay, so a nice, simple, we'll look at it that way. In Algeria, 1948, 140,000 Jews. 1958, 130,000 Jews. 1968, 1,500. From 130 to 1,500, and today, less than 50. Egypt, 1948, 75,000. 1958, 15,000. 1968, 1,000. And now, again, according to the best number, is 100. Iraq, 1948. In Iraq, 135,000. 1958, 6,000. Okay, today, soon to be less than 10. Lebanon, 1948, 5,000. Actually went up initially because, Lebanon was supposed to be a model, beautiful country, with everyone getting along with each other. It didn't work out that way. Anyway, today, less than 100. Libya, 1948, 38,000. 1958, 3,700. Today, zero. Zero. Morocco, 265,000, went down to 200,000 in 1958, 50,000 in 1968, today about 2,100. Syria, 30,000 in 1948, 5,000 in 1958, and now about 100. Tunisia, 105,000, down to 80,000 in 1958, 1968, 10,000, and now 1,050. Yemen, 63,000 in 1948, 4,000 in 1958, Today, less than 50. The totals, according to these numbers, 1948, in all these countries, 851,000 Jews. 1958, 469,000. 1968, 69,000. And 2018, about 3,300. So those are the numbers. So you can define expel in different ways.
Huh?
Say it again? Iran, I don't, is not on this list for whatever reason. A good question. You know, it's not an Arab country. This is Iran is not an Arab country. It's a Muslim country, not an Arab country. So, again, a forgotten piece of history. I tried to give you just an introduction to it, and I have more material here. I'm not always a good judge of how much time there is. But it bears reading. You can go online and see. I didn't invent anything here. You know, I just compiled a few different articles and a few different collections of material. But you can look, and it behooves us. Even those of us who are here and come from Ashkenazi backgrounds, we're well aware what happened in Europe, and it's not the same. There are many, many differences. I don't say it is. But we should be aware of the fact that, whatever the number is, whether it's 800,000, 850, 900, whatever the exact number is, Jews were expelled, or if you don't want to use the word expelled, forced out of Arab countries, persecuted in Arab countries, became refugees, okay? And as the writer Harris said at the beginning, we only look at one side of the quote-unquote refugee problem. I do want to, we do have permission on Tisha B'Av to end on a positive note. That there was some hope. As we know, the peace was arranged between Israel and certain Arab countries in the last number of years. Without going into too much, the so-called Abraham Accords, I don't want to wax too political. It did not get, in my opinion, the coverage that it should have gotten, even in American Jewish press, okay? Presumably because it was done by the Trump administration, so no newspapers wanted to give too much credit there, so it was kind of swept under the carpet or holding a nose, they mentioned it. But the fact is, it's extremely significant. It's extremely significant. So I'm going to read an article that was written by somebody from the United Arab Emirates, okay, to conclude with this. Emirati writer Salam Hamid, founder and head of the Al-Mezma Studies and Research Center in Dubai, which was published an article, and he published an article called, quote, "The Cost of the Expulsion of the Arab Jews." This was published in the United Arab Emirates daily paper Al-Ittihad, in which he lamented the expulsion of the Jews from the Arab countries following the establishment of Israel in 1948. He said this expulsion was a grave mistake, since the Arab countries thereby, quote, "lost an elite population with significant wealth, property, influence, knowledge, and culture," close quote, which could have helped them, including against Israel, ironically enough, okay, and lost the potential contribution of the Jews in many spheres, especially in the financial spheres. The Arabs, he added, should have learned the lesson from the expulsion of the Jews of Spain, which we also, of course, focus on at Tisha B'Av, in 1492, and from Hitler's expulsion of the Jews of Europe, which eventually harmed the countries that lost their Jews. Stated further that anti-Semitism, which is deeply entrenched in Arab society, stems from the books that teach Islamic heritage studied in schools throughout the Arab world that call for, and he therefore called for an overhaul of the curricula in order to strengthen tolerance and banish extremism. Here are some quotes from his article. Quote, "During the years that followed the declaration of the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, most Arab countries expelled their Jewish citizens, who numbered approximately 900,000, most of whom went to Israel. With this apparently strange behavior, the Arab countries gave a gift to the growing Hebrew nation. This makes me wonder, why were these people deported and what was their crime? Over time, this expulsion had disastrous repercussion when it turned out that the Arabs had lost an elite population, with significant wealth, property, influence, knowledge, and culture. Soon enough, the Arabs waged pointless wars against Israel until they were defeated in June 1967 with heavy losses. Nevertheless, the mentality of the Arab leadership persisted as they spun conspiracy theories to their defeated peoples and sought scapegoats in order to justify their repeated defeats at the hand of Israel." Another quote, "If you ever visit Israel, you will see citizens of diverse colors, just like in the U.S. They arrived as immigrants from across the globe of various races, and almost half of them are from Arab countries. Any intelligent person is aware that Jews had lived in Arab countries for 2,000 years before being arbitrarily expelled. Yet here they are now, making up half of Israel's citizens." Another quote. "Just a look at the number of Jews remaining in their Arab countries elucidates the difference between the past and the present. In the past, there were hundreds of thousands of Jewish citizens in Iraq, Egypt, Yemen, Syria, and the Maghreb." That's the western part of what do you call it? That's Tunisia, Algeria. Maghreb is the same word, Arab word, Ma'arav. You know, the iron, you know, the iron was iron. So Ma'arav, Maghreb. It means the west. It was the western. It was the westernmost part. Like sometimes you see in English, it's Sodom and Amora is translated Sodom and Gomorrah, right? Why? Because the iron is a guttural. The proper iron is a guttural. So Maghreb means Ma'arav. That was the most western part. And Gaza, same thing, right? Gaza also called it's Gaza in Chumash. It's Gaza, but they, right. So the Maghreb means the westernmost part of the Islamic world. Anyway, so in the past there were hundreds of thousands of Jewish citizens in Iraq, Egypt, Yemen, Syria, and the Maghreb. While today only dozens remain. Meanwhile, the Palestinians make up the largest group of asylum seekers in the world. Some 700,000 of them left their lands after the 1948 war, not just because of the war, but because of several Arab leaders who asked them to leave the Jewish areas so they could return after the fledgling Jewish state was destroyed. It is worth noting that in his memoir, Syria's then Prime Minister Khalid al-Azam acknowledged the role played by the Arabs in convincing the Palestinians to leave, a mistake whose severity the Arabs failed to grasp, which created the Palestinian refugee crisis and which prompted the founding of the United Nations Relief Works and so on in 1949. Another quote, our problem in the Arab world, and we'll finish up in a moment, our problem in the Arab world is our mindset and our hatred of the Jews. We have failed to learn the lesson of history when other nations before us expelled their Jewish citizens. When Spain expelled the Jews in 1492, the country and its colonies were deprived of a group of people known for their talents in economics and finance. As for Germany, it would have preceded the U.S. in creating the atomic bomb had Hitler not expelled the bomb's Jewish inventors such as Albert Einstein and Edward Teller. Had the Arabs even given a passing glance to the contribution made by the Jews, especially in the financial sector, during the Umayyad and Abbasid eras, those were Muslim, Muslim leaders or Muslim dynasties, they would have learned their lesson and not made the mistake of expelling Arab Jews who might even have aided the Arab regimes against Israel, ironically. Quote, this hatred for the Jews did not begin with the establishment state of Israel. It is an ideology that is still disseminated in the books that teach our heritage, which reflect the personal fatwas of bygone eras and were suited to those times which lack the openness of today. This hatred will therefore continue to exist so long as our heritage textbooks continue to incite hatred against the Jews as early as elementary school. Final quote, a fundamental change to educational programs across Arab countries is required. All inciting elements should be erased. The language of tolerance should be fortified, and any fanaticism, any particular school of thought or ideology should be avoided, because hatred is an infectious disease which negatively affects society and both simple and learned folk. That's this gentleman from United Arab Emirates, understanding what the expulsion of the Jews did to his country and to his people. And again, as I said, it's something we ought to bear in mind. On Tisha B'Av, we mourn and we take heed and pay attention to Golios that happened throughout. Our tradition is that we are based on the Rashi and the Yamim, that we always use Tisha B'Av as a mourning, even for events that did not have anything to do with the calendar date of Tisha B'Av necessarily. So many of the kinnis this morning spoke about the Crusades, made reference to other things, and of course, our shul, like many others, we said kinnis about the Holocaust at the end of the kinnis and so on. This is also something we have to be aware of. Many Jews lost their lives, yes, but again, it was an expulsion of Jews or forcing Jews out of their homeland, many of which were occupied by Jews for hundreds, if not thousands of years, and it's something that perhaps we weren't aware of and ought to be aware of. Thank you for listening, and have a meaningful rest of the feast.